morning. We have three cases scheduled for argument this morning. We understand counsel announced ready, declared the time that they want to take in the first two cases. So we'll call the first case on our 9 o'clock docket, Robert French versus Law Offices of Wendell Turley.
May it please the court, Jeff Anderson representing Bob French. I spoke with Mr. Keltner earlier, and I don't think either one of us is going to use our entire time. In my opening, I'm going to address the intentional infliction of emotional distress, and then after Mr. Keltner addresses his cross-appeal points, I will address our points as cross-appellee. Your Honors, this case is important today, and Mr. Turley's not here. Mr. French is on his way here, and I know the court, since I've been in front of the court for 16 years, is very familiar with this case since it's been up before the court before, and there's a Dallas Court of Appeals case, but I do think it's important with regard to the claim of intentional emotional distress to review briefly the facts that gave rise to the claim that Mr. French made against Mr. Turley. If we go back really 14 years ago when the relationship began with Mr. Turley and Mr. French, we see a period of continual abuses of the attorney-client relationship by Mr. Turley against Mr. French. It began with the assignment of the case to a lawyer who didn't do anything, sent the case back. Mr. French brought the case back to Mr. Turley. Mr. Turley said, okay, I'll work on this case. This looks good. He took it back. For a while, he had Mr. Sawicki work on it, and Mr. Sawicki did a good job while he was with the Law Offices of Wendell Turley. And at some point, as the court knows from the record, Mr. Sawicki departed his employment with the Law Offices of Wendell Turley. At that point, Wendell Turley committed another misstep at that point by assigning a lawyer who'd never done a malpractice case to Mr. French's case. Mr. French met with that lawyer and determined, one, which is undisputed, that the lawyer couldn't even remember the name of Mr. French's deceased wife. And the lawyer said to Mr. French, well, I'm looking forward to learning this medical malpractice stuff. So Mr. French was understandably dissatisfied with that, and he went to Mr. Turley to discuss some arrangement with Mr. Sawicki, and allowing Mr. Sawicki to keep the case and somehow split the fee and pay Mr. Turley the expenses. At that point, because of Mr. Turley's either anger over the situation in general or hatred for Mike Sawicki, Mr. Turley engaged in a pattern of behavior over the next few years that's atrocious. And as we sit here today and our profession is continually under attack, what occurred here that resulted in the $1.5 million judgment is clearly a violation of not only the attorney-client relationship, but any decency in conducting business. Mr. Turley refused to enter into a fee-splitting arrangement, which when he wasn't even doing any of the work, Mr. Sawicki was going to do the work. He sent the case to Mr. Sawicki and demanded that Mr. Sawicki represent Bob French without obtaining any fee at all. Once Mr. Sawicki said that situation is untenable and sent the case back to Mr. Turley, Mr. Turley had Mr. French and the boxes met in the lobby and said, we're not taking your case, even though he refused to allow Mr. Sawicki to work on it. At that point, we know from the record and we know from the other opinions that Mr. French filed a grievance against Mr. Turley. Mr. Turley refused to comply with orders of the grievance committee. Mr. Turley refused to go to honor any mediation agreement that they tried to work out. Then Mr. Turley intervened in the case, filed a lawsuit against Mr. French in the wrong venue in Dallas County, was sanctioned for that behavior, and continually harassed Mr. French. Now, while Mr. Turley is doing these things to attack Mr. French, Mr. Sawicki goes down, tries what is a difficult medical malpractice case, and prevails. Mr. Turley intervenes in that case while he's also suing Bob French in Dallas and also failing to act as the grievance committee orders down in Austin, and seeks his entire fee. Well, originally Judge Enloe said that's not tenable and granted summary judgment. This court, in reviewing the record of what had gone on, originally said, and you can't find the opinion on Westlaw anymore, but Judge Casey Justice Casey, recites the unconscionable behavior by Wendell Turley in trying to collect the fee. Then this court reviewed the record again and wrote another opinion, remanding the case to trial on various grounds, all of which were non-suited by Turley before the trial. So Turley proceeded to trial on the claim of quantum merit. In reviewing this appeal and the facts that we have before us, this court has to look at every inference that supports the jury's verdict in favor of the $1.4 million. And essentially, when we look at the record, we have to find three elements. One, that there was intentional acts or reckless disregard. Well, there's no doubt that everything that Mr. Turley did in his pursuit and aggravation and attack of Mr. French was done intentionally. Mr. Turley doesn't even dispute that. Everything Mr. Turley did for avaricious goals or greed or to get back at Mr. Sawicki at Mr. French's expense was done intentionally. So the record completely establishes the first element of an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, that the acts were done intentionally. The second thing that we have to establish is that the acts were extreme. And in that regard, the court looking at the record has a series of acts, some of which are simply an effort to collect a fee, some of which may be a judgment call in suing his client in the wrong county, some of which may be a decision to contest or a decision not to follow the grievance committee's orders. And what the law offices of Wendell Turley has taken the position that there's these protections for each one of these actions. And that really if you're upset that Mr. Turley is doing these things, you should sue him for abuse of process. Or if he's filed in the wrong county, like the Dallas court ordered, that the remedy for that is to get sanctions, which the Dallas court gave. And that's true, that there are protections for some of these acts, but the entire course of conduct that Mr. Turley engaged in with his client in a fiduciary relationship when he knew that his client had suffered through the loss of his wife is unconscionable and extreme.
Tell us specifically, counsel, what acts you're referring to, acts which the Supreme Court and Credit Watch say that must rise to the level of, bordering criminal conduct.
And that is the way that case reads. I'm not certain that the Supreme Court says that it's got to be almost borderline criminal.
Well, just then tell us what acts you're referring to.
The acts that I'm referring to
fit in this category of outrageous and extreme.
The first act that's outrageous and extreme, and if you would, each one of these acts I don't view separately. I view it as a course. And I think the law views it as a course of conduct that if you stack 1, 2, and 3, you have come up with 4, which is the extreme conduct. But the first act is the refusal to work with Mr. Sawicki in negotiating a fee arrangement. That's the beginning. That's not a criminal act. The second act is the position of putting Mr. French in a position where he can't get any representation because Mr. Turley will not release his fee unless he brings the case back to the law offices of Wendell Turley. The third act, on top of that, is the refusal to take the case back once he's put Mr. French in that condition. The fourth act is suing your client, which you know is wrong, in the wrong county for which he got sanctioned. The fifth act is the refusal to comply with the grievance committee hearings. The sixth act is putting Mr. French, when he's in the course of trying to recover for the loss of his wife, in a position where all he can do is worry about Mr. Turley's continued avaricious acts and attempts to extract money or conduct out of Mr. French by bringing the case back when he wouldn't even accept it. And there are others scattered throughout the record.
But would you agree, though, Counselor, that for the most part, in each of these instances that you identified as cumulatively getting to extreme and outrageous, that whether you agree with it or not, or like it or not, that Mr. Turley was taking a legal position and that had arguable merit in each of these areas?
I would agree that most of them do. I would say that from I've been practicing law for 16 years here. Mr. Keltner's been practicing for 40
Forever.
Years, for 50 or 60. But neither one of us, and I don't want to speak for the court, but none of you would have done what Mr. Turley did with regard to the fee split arrangement. And yes, that may be a tenable legal position, but it is an atrocious position when you hold someone's trust and confidence as a lawyer. So, yes, Your Honor, now the two things that I do not think are appropriate and a legal position are the failure to take the case back when he had essentially made it so that Mr. French could not get representation from Mr. Sawicki. That's not a tenable legal position. Filing the lawsuit in Dallas County, although I've heard arguments that attempt to make that a tenable legal position, I do not believe it is. And I don't believe that if you ask 10 lawyers right now if that was correct, that they would have said that was a tenable legal position. But with regard to attempting to collect a fee, yes, that's a tenable legal position, and that's something that Mr. Turley would be entitled to do. But it is not a tenable legal position to say I get the entire fee when the case has not been tried yet. And if I don't get the entire fee, I'm going to make it so that you can't try it. That's not right.
So with respect to the tenable legal position facts, do we consider that in reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence, or do we take those acts out and then just look at what you contend were acts that upon which there was no tenable legal position?
I think you must consider it, and here's why. And I realize clearly that there's case law out there that says acts that are privileged in our legal positions, there's case after case after case, it says that is not evidence of extreme conduct.
So why should we consider it if it's not evidence?
Because I think for two reasons. The first reason being the relationship between the lawyer and the client and the duties owed to the client by the lawyer. This is not the same as an arm's length transaction. And in that particular instance, I think we also must consider the state of the client at the time the acts are conducted. So we may have what in an arm's length transaction would be a tenable position, but in a fiduciary relationship where we already know that the person to whom the fiduciary duties is owed is in a fragile state, I think the court should look at acts that, when combined with other acts, create extreme and outrageous conduct. I see my 2 minutes are up. The last bit of evidence that is in the record is evidence of extreme emotional distress. Mr. French testified, and no one contends, that he did not suffer emotional distress. He lost sleep. He lost his business now. He has tremors. He had nausea. All directly related to what Mr. Turley did to him. So in closing, Your Honors, the evidence viewed most favorable to the appellant in this case requires a reversal of Judge Wade's JNOV and an entry that Robert French take $1.4 million from the law offices of Wendell Turley for the extreme and outrageous conduct that it conducted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Keltner.
If it pleases the court, the majority of our arguments are legal rather than factual, but I do want to address a couple of the factual issues up front because the basis of Mr. French's claim is that Mr. Turley always insisted on a 45% fee. The record does not bear that out, and I'm going to give you record references because I think they're important. First off, at volume 4, page 169, now I'll admit this is directly in front of the trial judge, not the jury. This quote, "We indicated to Mr. French at Mr. Turley's deposition that we would not seek more We would not seek, nor had we ever sought, any money other than money Sawicki is holding, that we will never seek a dime from Mr. French. What Mr. Sawicki was holding, the evidence showed, was $32,000 in fees that had been expended by Wendell Turley's office to pursue the claim, and as of the date of trial had not been paid, and $250,000 in attorney's fees. In the record, at Volume 4, pages 28 through 29, there's a stipulation by Turley between the lawyers that they are only seeking the money from Sawicki's fees, not fees on top of Mr. Sawicki's. In the final argument of pages, Volume 5, pages 35, 37, and 41, the same information is discussed with the jury over and over again. In other words, no one is trying to collect a full fee, just a portion of Mr. Sawicki's 45% that he charged and put in his escrow account. Mr. French had long since been paid all of his money. Now, I think legal issues drive this case, and there are three cases that are not cited in Mr. French's brief that direct the court's attention on intentional infliction of mental distress. They are Credit Watch, Zeltwanger, and the Tiller case. All post-date the cases cited by Mr. French, and all are Texas Supreme Court cases. The court is well familiar with Credit Watch as it came from this court, and also several of the other authorities we are going to cite as well. First, let me say that up front there is a problem with the intentional infliction of emotional distress tort in this situation, because as the Supreme Court said in Credit Watch and Zeltwanger, the real truth of the matter is it is a gap filler tort not meant to replace any common law existing tort or any statutory tort. And that's exactly what Credit Watch says. And in fact, Judge Brister, talking about it, says the tort has boundaries. And it said in Credit Watch, if there's a common law cause of action that exists or a statutory cause of action, the plaintiff can't rely on intentional infliction of emotional distress. That came actually from an original holding in Zeltwanger, which had been decided the year before in 2004. Now, there were common law torts available to Mr. French. You just heard his counsel admit that. That precludes the recovery up front. But and those were pretty clear. There were malicious prosecution if he believed that. And by the way, all of these torts are much harder to prove than intentional infliction of mental distress. Or there was a bar to that recovery that Mr. French couldn't get over. That's why they went with the intentional infliction of mental distress. First, malicious prosecution requires actual malice, which would be difficult to prove, and a proof of special damages in which mental anguish may not apply. Additionally, there would be the frivolous lawsuit allegations. And let me tell you about that because it's been mentioned several times. There were sanctions entered against Wendell Turley. The record reflects why Mr. Turley filed the suit that he did in Dallas County, and it was because of yet another case in which Mr. Sawicki had gotten his intervention for fees dismissed in a case in Denton County, and they wanted to prevent that. But the courts decided against us on that, and I think we are bound by that. So I'm not questioning the decision at all. What I will say is that Mr. Turley paid Mr. French $30,000 as a result of that issue, pursuant to that order, and that issue is over and has been compensated, and any other issues of malicious prosecution in the Dallas case could have been brought there. Finally, he says in the brief that we owed him a fiduciary duty. That's not true, as this court knows and is held by you in the Addicks versus Sickle case. Judge Dofano, you were on that opinion. Once a law firm's representation or a lawyer's representation is terminated, the fiduciary duty ends, period and paragraph. That had been the law in good faith cases before, once coverage was denied and litigation was started between the two parties. Now, interestingly, in Credit Watch, in reaching the decision this was a gap filler tort and wouldn't replace statutory and common law causes of actions, relied on a New York case, Thompson versus Sweet, and this is footnote 3 in our brief, and it's important because in Thompson versus Sweet, there was a possibility of the plaintiff filing a malicious prosecution action, and the court there held, yes, you're limited to that. You can't go to intentional infliction of mental distress. So based on that issue, I think it's very clear that the gap filler test would not apply. The next thing is the conduct extreme and outrageous? Justice Casey has already commented on this. Here's what I would say. This, of course, is a question of law. Three cases that we talked about, Credit Watch, Zeltwanger, and Tiller, all deal with this issue. None are mentioned in French's briefing. In Credit Watch, and I won't go into the facts because you remember them, horrible facts, kind of facts that we would hate to see in any kind of situation with sexual harassment, retaliation, telling employees what they could do in dealing with a young woman who had been the subject of sexual harassment, absolutely horrible. The Supreme Court even characterized those acts as callous, mean-spirited, overreaching, and even vindictive, the very claim Mr. French has here, and it permeates his brief. But were those enough to be extreme and outrageous, which is a question for the court reviewed by you de novo? No. The Supreme Court said not, and said it's got to be much more than that, and it says as well that it has to be more than heinous, and I quote, bordering on serious criminal acts. I think we admit we don't have those here. And in fact, we even went further because in that case, they did exactly what Mr. French does here and talk about a vendetta. And Justice Brister takes that on and says, no, and a vendetta is not enough. Zeltwanger, factually, is even a worse case than Credit Watch. Horrible situations there with a young woman who is harassed, people going through her underwear drawer, making lewd comments about her, questioning what she was wearing underneath her outside clothing in front of others. And Chief Justice Phillips again addressed the same issue of extreme and outrageous and said that doesn't rise to the level of extreme and outrageous conduct. Tiller is a case that is much like this one. It is a business relations case. In Tiller, what happened is the McClures ran a mom-and-pop business that did prefabricated warehouses, and Tiller ordered a bunch of them for a warehouse operation. What happened is Mr. McClure became terribly ill, got cancer, was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and had a horrible last illness. During all that period of time, Tiller was calling and claiming they were behind schedule, when in fact the evidence showed they were not. It went on for a period of time, and poor Mrs. McClure, his mom-and-pop operation, took over the business, operated it. He dies. On the day before the funeral, they let Tiller know they're going to close the plant so all the employees can go to the proprietor's funeral. Mr. Tiller throws a fit. He says, I'll cancel the contract. I'll pull the work from you if you close the plant for so people can't go to the funeral. Really obscene conduct. But it wasn't enough to be extreme and outrageous conduct. And in a per curiam opinion in 2003, that's what the court said. Now, also, the issue raised also by Judge Casey, we believe is true, is that everything that was done in this case was in an effort to recover a fee. Now, Credit Watch talked to that. In footnote 20, they cite the restatement. And Justice Brister says, even if, and this is what it says, and I'm quoting again, an actor is never liable where he has done no more than insist on legal rights in a permissible way, even if he is aware that such insistence is certain to cause emotional distress. Now, the 1969 decision of Mandel and Wright versus Thompson spells out the rights between lawyers and contingent fee contracts when clients discharge them. And it gives the right, whether discharged with or without a cause, to pursue those legal fees, and that's what happened. Again, in this case, nothing was pursued that would have caused Mr. French to pay more than the 40% to 45% that he was entitled, that he had contracted for. And I think that's important to this issue. The other thing that I want to briefly turn to is our appellate point, and it is the zero finding on the value of the legal services. And I think it's important for the court to look at the charge at the trial court level to see what we're talking about. And our point is that that finding of zero on the value of the services is against the great weight of the preponderance and the preponderance of the evidence, and, in fact, the evidence conclusively proved that there was some value. And I'll admit that's a heavy burden for us, but I think in a quick view of this record, which is really truly only about a day and a half trial, is pretty easy to read. There are only two witnesses that were ever asked to comment on this, interestingly. Steve Maxwell, who was the expert witness for Mr. Turley, and then also Mr. Sawicki, who is the person who delivered the services. Remember, what had happened is that everything that occurred in Mr. Sawicki had this case for a long time while he was at the law offices of Wendell Turley. He admitted that the work he did there added great value. Now, the interesting issue here is, that was the issue, value. And the issue that was submitted here, remember, this charge did not submit the liability part for quantum merit. Judge Wade determined that that had been conclusively established. So PJC 101.42 wasn't submitted. The only thing was the amount of the value of the services. There is no complaint on appeal about that decision at all. So all we're talking to do is value. No doubt that Mr. Sawicki...
Did Judge Wade determine that the quantum merit was conclusively established in favor of Mr. Turley?
Yes. Had to have with that submission.
Okay.
And again, no complaint on appeal. The only thing that is submitted is the amount of the value of the services. Mr. Sawicki, in call to testify, and this is at volume 4, page 30, testifies that when he left, they had received a settlement offer, and at page 30 he says it's between $125,000 and $150,000, and if you applied the fee to that, that would be the value of the services when he left. That would be either $50,000 or $60,000. Later, at page 72 of the same volume, he remembers that it is the entire amount of $150,000. On final argument, he says... He tells the jury the work he did was valuable and again values the case at $150,000 and asks the jury to enter a verdict on that amount, which would be $60,000. Now, in their brief, here's what they say about that. They say, first off, well, the real truth of the matter is that it was $60,000 at the most. If you look at page 30, that is not true. What he's saying is he could, at that time, couldn't remember whether it was $125,000 or $150,000. That's the only thing he was distinguishing. Second, they also say it was not based on value, because that's what the question asked. I'm going to read you from that same passage. If you are asking, this is Mr. Sawicki, who is Mr. French's lawyer, if you are asking me what the value was, it would have been the offer that was on the table at the time. $125,000 to $150,000. Two lines later, I determined would be the value of the case when I left Turley was $150,000. 40% of that is $60,000. And then he asked the jury in final argument to return that amount. Steve Maxwell testified to higher figures.
Are you aware of any other case, counsel, where the value of a contingent fee contract was determined by hourly rate information?
Your Honor, there are a number of cases that deal with this. I'm not aware as I talk to you about that, but there are discussions in quantum merit claims, and in quantum merit you would value the services separately from the contract itself. You would not do that in this case because this is an exception to the quantum merit contract issue on discharge with and without cause.
I've got it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Keltner.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, I'm going to briefly address the issues with regard to our appointed as appellee. And, Justice Casey, you hit right on the head of of the focus on, of the in reviewing the evidence, and I'm not going to belabor the point of what burden they have to establish on a weight and preponderance appellate issue in a quantum merit claim. But their burden that they have today is just the same burden they had at the trial court almost, and they couldn't carry it then. And if you look at the evidence that's in the record, you've got, they called two witnesses, Mike Sawicki and Steve Maxwell, in all deference to Mr. Maxwell, who we all know. They only gave him the case for an hour before he got there. But neither one of those lawyers introduced evidence that would be competent to support a jury's finding. Mr. Sawicki's evaluation of the portion of a contingency fee based on the offer at the time the case leaves Mr. Turley's office is not evidence of what the value of the services is toward the ultimate recovery. So that's, you take that and toss that out the window, because that's not evidence of what the value of the services would be. When Mr. Maxwell takes the stand, he tosses out three different calculations, one that ends up being more than the actual fee to begin with. Well, that's not competent evidence. The second one, and all of these are based on Wendell Turley's estimated hourly rate, which, one, the evidence is clear, Mr. Turley never worked on the case. So that's an inappropriate way to evaluate it. You would evaluate it by taking the hourly rate, if you were going to do that method, of the lawyer who's actually working on the case, or the lawyer who would have been working on the case had Mr. Turley taken the case back. But all of Mr. Maxwell's evaluations are erroneously made, and there are three of them. He's an expert on the stand, but his testimony is contradicted and confusing, so it's not, the jury's not bound to take any of his evaluations. And at the end of his testimony, I assume he looks at the jury when he says, well, it's up to the jury to decide what the value is. And the jury did decide what the value was. Zero. Because not only did the jury hear from Mr. Maxwell and Mr. Sawicki, but the jury heard about all of the other things that Mr. Turley did that didn't advance the ball in the case. I mean, really, if we're looking at what the value that Mr. Turley's office gave to the case, you have to consider everything that he did and that that law office did during the course of the case. And the jury, after hearing all the things that had happened, decided that the value was zero, which is not surprising, because that's the same jury that assessed $1.5 million or $1.4 million against Turley for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
So you say the jury, I mean, seeing that the depositions were taken while the Frenches were represented by the Turley law firm, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you believe that it would be appropriate to say there's absolutely no value on the taking of a deposition of a material witness? Is that, I mean...
No. But I am saying that...
It's the costs and expenses of traveling to the site of the deposition would be... I mean, there's some value there.
There is some value, and all of us who practice in this courtroom know that. And Mr. Sawicki admitted that on the stand. There is some value. It is their burden to establish what the value is by looking at the depositions we're taking and saying, this is the deposition of the expert on the other side and what that expert's going to establish. And the reason that's important, jurors, is because without that testimony, we couldn't carry our burden in a medical malpractice claim. And here is the discovery that was taken. The reason this discovery is important, because it shows us what the physicians did on the other side and what the documents are that we can impeach their expert with.
So you're saying that they didn't put on any of that type of evidence of how what they did advanced the ball, as you put it?
No, they did not. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. The evidence in the record is empty of what the value actually is, and as a result, the jury was left with the conclusion that the value is zero, which is supported by the record.
So let me ask then, you do not agree with any kind of remand then on this issue?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I believe our request is obviously a reversal and rendition of the 1.4 and an affirmance of the judgment that the law offices of Wendell Turley take nothing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, Mr. Keltner, Mr. Sanders. We appreciate your arguments this morning. They were both very helpful and well done. The case is submitted, and you're all excused. Thank you.